From Iowa Public Radio News, I'm Ben Kiefer. This is The Exchange. Today, we follow up with Des Moines explorer and adventurer Charlie Whitmack. His 11-month journey is an unprecedented 10,000-mile triathlon from England to the summit of Mount Everest. We last spoke with Charlie in August after he finished swimming the English Channel. Now we check in with him after his bicycle trip over a more than 12,000-foot mountain range on the border between Kyrgyzstan and China. We'll also talk with Dr. Yogi Shah, Associate Dean of Global Health at Des Moines University. In connection with the World Triathlon, Dr. Shah is leading an effort to try to reduce maternal mortality in Nepal. That's all coming up. First, this news. It's The Exchange from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer, and today we follow up with Des Moines explorer and adventurer Charlie Whitmack. You may remember we last spoke with Charlie in August after he finished swimming the English Channel. That was the first part of the first leg in this incredible 11-month journey he's on, an unprecedented 10,000-mile triathlon from England to the summit of Mount Everest. Recently, he completed the second leg of the World Triathlon, a bicycle journey over a more than 12,000-foot mountain range on the border between Kyrgyzstan and China. Charlie Whitmack joins us again today. He's back in Iowa, and he joins us from the studios of Iowa Public Radio in Des Moines. Welcome back to our program, Charlie.
Thanks so much, Ben. It's always always great to be with you.
Joining you also in that studio, Dr. Yogi Shah, Associate Dean of Global Health at Des Moines University. In connection with this World Triathlon, Dr. Shah is helping out, leading an effort to try to reduce maternal mortality in Nepal. It's all connected together. We'll explain that a little bit. Let's do that right off the bat, Charlie. For those who are hearing about this for the first time, let's talk about the physical aspect of what you're doing and how it's coupled with humanitarian efforts here. Tell us, first of all, what your World Tri is all about, why you're doing it.
Sure, sure. Yeah, the expedition is, I guess, the easiest way of saying it. It's roughly 100 times the length of an Ironman triathlon. So the expedition started July 1st in rural England with a swim down the River Thames through Oxford and central London to the North Sea and then around the coast of the United Kingdom and finally across the English Channel to France. That was a swim of about 250 miles altogether. And then from France, I jumped on a bicycle and headed across 13 countries where I'll end up in India. And then from India, the expedition finishes this spring with a 1,200-mile run up into the Himalayas and a climb to the summit of Mount Everest. And so I'm about halfway through right now in time. It's a year-long expedition roughly altogether, and taking a few weeks off here for the holidays and came home to see Dr. Shah and the other physicians at Mercy and Des Moines University to make sure that I was physically checked out and ready to go back to Mount Everest.
You make it sound so easy in that description, and there's a lightness in your voice, and we'll explore some of the things you've already experienced there. But first, Dr. Shah, welcome to our program as well.
Good morning. Thank you, Ben. Thanks for inviting me. And great to be with Charlie.
Great to have you on the program. Tell us about the humanitarian mission connected with this World Tri.
What's happened, Ben, is that by the time Charlie starts his second phase of World Tri, from January to June, there'll be more than 200,000 women will die giving birth. And many of them will die in sub-Saharan Africa and Southeast Asia, many in Nepal. So when Charlie and I met first time to talk about his World Tri, we talked about global health and see how global health can become part of his World Tri. And Charlie immediately liked the idea, so we thought that Nepal will focus on Nepal and see how we can produce some nice project about reducing maternal mortality in regions where Charlie will be walking, running, and preparing for his climb.
Mm-hmm. And as Charlie has completed legs of this triathlon, what has been have you accomplished on the humanitarian mission side?
The humanitarian mission is broken up into different pieces, and it's been interesting politically as I've moved through these countries to try to integrate a health program in a country like Nepal. And for people following the international news, Nepal doesn't frequently make the headlines, but it's been operating now without a government for about the last 2.5 years. In the last year, there was a constitutional convention, and we were very hopeful that there would be a government installed by the time I got to Kathmandu. Unfortunately, it didn't happen, and the constitutional convention failed. It was dismissed then, and Nepal is continuing to operate without a government. So one thing we've been doing here in the fall was trying to work with various stakeholders in Nepal to, frankly, get approval for our program to operate in Nepal. And it wasn't actually been until I got to Kathmandu here about 10 days ago that we finally got that approval and are ready now to start moving forward in Nepal. So as you work through these countries, even on the physical side of the expedition, there's a lot of things like this that we don't anticipate in advance and just take a lot of time to get operational on the ground. Mm-hmm. Now, the good news is now that we've made those connections, we'll be able to begin operating. Dr. Shaw is going to come in January. We'll have a team there doing some work in March and then again next October. And hopefully this is the beginning of a long relationship for us with Nepal.
Let's turn to your bike journey over the recent bike journey that you had. We talked with you in August. You had completed your swimming leg of the triathlon, and the end of that was swimming the English Channel. You did have some sort of pneumonia, actually, when you did swim. You completed the English Channel swim. Pick up the story from there. What did you do as you started your bike journey? Where was that?
The bike journey started actually in the exact part where the swim left off, and that was something I had strategically been trying to get lined up. And when you're in the ocean there in the English Channel, you're really at the whim of the tides. And so I had an excellent captain that got me across the English Channel and landed in just the right place in Cap Grenet, France, where I could begin the bicycle ride. And so I started on the sand there at the water, just like you start rag bride, dipping your tire in the water, and then began cycling. So it was a very quick trip across northern France into Belgium, down across Belgium, across Germany then, up the Rhine Valley, and then we doubled back into Prague. When we reached Prague, my support team and my wife and son, who had been traveling with me, went home, and I continued on then from there by myself. And then cycling alone, I finished up the Czech Republic, headed into Poland, crossed Poland, Ukraine, and then into Russia. And again, when I reached Russia, I had to have an escort with me there because it's required by the visa. So I cycled then across Russia, Kazakhstan, which was the country I spent the most time in, the small country of Kyrgyzstan, up over the northern tip of the Himalayas there, into China, and then up to the state of Tibet, and then into Nepal.
Mm-hmm. You have some. We want to remind people that you, your wife Kate, also helped out keeping track of you, so that we all know where you were on your blog, which people can find at worldtry.com. Is that it?
It's theworldtry.com, or on Facebook at facebook.com/theworldtry.
Really, some magnificent photos of your journey over these mountain passes. Those huge photos, are those the ones in Kyrgyzstan?
Yeah, there was a photo essay there about the Torgard Pass in China. And the Torgard Pass is important as a physical obstacle, but also as a historic landmark. It is the border in the pass that separates Kyrgyzstan from China, and it's part of the ancient Silk Road. So there's landmarks along that route there that are literally thousands and thousands of years old. So I had the opportunity while cycling through there to get to visit some of those. Mm-hmm. In addition to the historical piece, it's a big mountain pass. It's very difficult to cycle over. I went through the photo essay I think that you're referring to online tells the story of how I went through. I finished on the fifth bicycle. I broke a number of bicycles trying to get up through that Torgard Pass and ultimately crossed the border at dusk after having cycled a distance of about 100 miles, the last half of which was all across snow and ice. So it was a very, very tough day for me.
So you had several bicycles in your entourage, several bicycles, replacement bicycles, in case one
breaks. At that point, you know, I didn't have the extras. So that's what was kind of funny about the story was I went up on the bike I'd ridden all the way from Prague. And that bike broke just as soon as I started climbing up the first little bit of climbing there on Torgard. So I headed back to the capital of Bishkek. I found another bike, which I could rent. I brought that up. That bike broke the next day and was subsequently stolen. I went back to Bishkek, rented a second bike. That bike broke as soon as I started pedaling. On the fourth attempt, then the support vehicle, we broke the wheel and tire on the support vehicle. And then finally, on the fifth attempt, I ended up just riding on my old touring bike with only one gear. So I ended up doing all that climbing with just one gear on the bicycle across the snow and ice.
If you just joined us, I'm talking with Des Moines explorer and adventurer Charlie Whitmack, also Dr. Yogi Shah of the Des Moines University. Charlie is in the midst of an 11-month journey on an unprecedented 10,000-mile world triathlon from England to the summit of Mount Everest. He just completed the bike leg of this triathlon. If you have a question for Charlie Whitmack or Dr. Yogi Shah, 1-866-780-9100, 1-866-780-9100, the exchange at iowapublicradio.org. And so several broken bikes, other broken equipment. Let's talk about Charlie's body. How did Charlie's body hold up there?
Boy, it has been a day by day and just a battle to get through this thing, Ben, as far as we've made it. And the challenge has really started right away. Swimming in the River Thames, I had a case of dysentery, which was diagnosed as an amoebic dysentery. That happened just upriver from the town of Oxford. I had a second battle with that. The first time I actually had to go to the hospital over it. The second battle with that was about 10 days or 2 weeks later down near the town of Whitstable, which is on the there in the Thames estuary after London. You mentioned earlier the pneumonia, which came up really, it was more of a case of aspiration just from swimming every day, 8 to 10 to 12 hours a day. You can't help but breathe in a lot of this water, and it's very difficult for your body to get rid of that water. So the water piled up in my lungs and had a very difficult crossing of the English Channel. By bike then, the first 30 days of cycling, it rained 24 days. And about on the third day, it was raining so hard, I actually got an ear infection. So imagine swimming 5 weeks, 8 to 12 hours a day, no ear infection, and there was so much moisture and water and rain during the bike ride, I got an ear infection. From there, it was just a lot of kind of normal rag-bri aches and pains, you know, getting my rear end into shape, getting my muscles and legs ready to do this big bike ride. And then the next major problem really came in Kazakhstan when I was actually hit by a car on the M32 highway in central Kazakhstan.
Tell us that story. How did that happen?
Well, I was riding down the highway. It's a very remote part of Kazakhstan. I had spent almost 3 weeks cycling across a desert, portions of which I was cycling through 18 inches of sand. And there's some photos of that on the website. And I got out of the desert onto an asphalt road, and there was very little traffic. So I had a habit of riding on the left side of the road because then I could see if there was a car coming toward me. I could get off into the shoulder and just get out of the way and let it pass. These are drivers that aren't necessarily used to seeing people cycling along the roadside, so I wanted to be well out of their way. What happened and what surprised me was there was a vehicle that came up behind me, and at the same time there was a second vehicle coming up behind me that decided to pass. And so that second vehicle, there just wasn't enough room there in the road for two vehicles and a bicycle. And as I said, I didn't see them. So the passing vehicle came very, very quickly. And the first sound I heard was the ping sound of that car. It had hit my rear bike rack. And in doing that, it had knocked the wheels out from under me. And I popped off the bike. My head and my helmet hit the rear passenger door of the car as it passed by. And then I hit the asphalt very, very hard and slid down the highway, I think a distance of about 15 to 20 feet.
Mm, but now is any of your entourage with you at this point?
No, it's a...
You're solo.
I was escorted at this point, but we didn't have the ability to stay together throughout the day. It's... You know, 10 to 12 hours of cycling every day for what was about 5 months. So it's not reasonable to have a two-person escort stay with you at all times when you're cycling. So our tradition and our program was I would cycle 40 kilometers at a time. And they would wait for me at 40 kilometers. I would pass by. They would wait maybe a half hour and then begin driving. So I would see them, you know, usually every hour. But this was a section when we were separated when this happened.
And so you're there in the road. What happened next?
Yeah, so I opened my eyes. I must have been knocked unconscious just briefly. And when I opened my eyes, being a cyclist all my life, you know, when this happens, your immediate impression is to get out of the road.
Right, don't get run
over.
Because
you can be hit down and then run over. And so I opened my eyes and I scampered sort of like a crab out of the highway onto the back into the sand. And then when I looked around, there was a group of people standing around me, and they were all extremely surprised. I think they thought I might have been killed. You know, I'd been laying here in the middle of the highway for long enough for them to stop their vehicles and get out and come look at me. And then all of a sudden, I spring back to life. And so
you were
motion,
what,
you know,
several seconds? Several seconds or several minutes, Darren?
I just can't tell you. You know, in my memory of the experience I live this experience almost every day and every night when I'm trying to get to sleep. And what I hear is the ting of that car hitting me, and then the thump of my head hitting the car. And then that's really the end of the memory until I was sitting, you know, next to the road and kind of going through my body and trying to figure out if there was an injury.
Mm-hmm. And so you got some medical care eventually, and the outcome when all was said and done about this accident?
You know, got to get back on the bike, got to keep riding.
No big injuries.
No big injuries. No, mm-hmm. I came down on my right side, and so I hit the asphalt so hard that I had these big blood blisters down my hand and on my shoulder and hip, and a little bit of road rash, you know, quite stiff and sore for the next few days. And frankly, mentally, it was very, very tough to get back on the bike.
Was that your toughest physical challenge and mental challenge of this bike leg?
You know, Tibet, the mental challenges get harder every day. It's like a tractor pull. You know, you start out an expedition, you've been with your family, you have a sense of euphoria, you're getting started, and then every day it gets a little harder. And
you're climbing in altitude, right?
You're climbing in altitude. I cycled over the Torgard Pass. I got to a town called Kashgar, which is next to the Taklamakan Desert in the very western part of China. And to get from the desert to Tibet, you have to cross a series of mountain passes. And there's three mountain passes there. I call them the Father, Son, and Holy Ghost. The first one is 3,900 meters. The second, 4,900 meters. The last one, 5,200 meters. So the last one's over 18,000 feet. Mm. So they're massive. It's 10 to 11,000 feet of climbing every day to get over these three passes. And there's really no road. There's a path there. It's not gravel. It's really rocks. And so it's very difficult cycling, 100-mile climbs, 120-mile days, trying to get up over these passes and get up into Tibet.
Wow. And I imagine go ahead.
As I started working up over those passes, I had I had compressed my schedule too long because I had been set behind earlier in the trip. And so I had a pulmonary and a cerebral edema during the final climb there.
Now, you mentioned earlier about getting your seat used to the bike. Many of us can only imagine ragbri people out there listening to this conversation, or even those of us who take off for a weekend of biking and have a sore tush afterwards. You know, how is this when you go on such an extreme bike trip? What do you do?
There's a lot of aches and pains, and I guess it starts with the thing that really aggravated this was the rain. So, you know, as I rode across Belgium and Germany, and like I said, 24 days of rain in the first 30 days, and that was really tough. So, yeah, so the skin's peeling off the backside, you know, it's absolute agony. I had a terrible rash that I don't think I got rid of until almost the time I reached Kathmandu. And so that's a hard part, too, and I think people of Iowa can relate to that.
Right, and the wrists are important, too, because there's a lot of, depending on your bike construction, design, there's a lot of pressure on your wrists. You have any problems there?
You know, my wrists and arms held up pretty well. I think I had a lot of strength after the channel swim. The channel swim, actually, after finishing that 250-mile swim, I thought I actually broke my arm. And so I had a lot of arm pain for the first few weeks. And after about a month of cycling, I started to feel pretty good and strong.
Charlie Whitmack is with us, back the Des Moines explorer and adventurer who's just completed his second leg of his world triathlon, along with Dr. Yogi Shah of the Des Moines University. And let's go back to talk just a couple minutes before our break about the humanitarian side of this, Charlie and Dr. Shah. Talk a little bit more about aspects of what you're trying to do in terms of focusing on Nepal and women, preventing women from dying in childbirth. What is normally going on there in Nepal with the childbirth that we can make strides into preventing childbirth death?
So, Ben, what happens in many developing countries, including India and Nepal, is that the technologies are there. The deaths of these mothers and children is no medical mystery. what we need to do, and that's where DMU comes in play, is increase awareness and education. Awareness that mothers don't have to die during childbirth, that there are health systems available, simple health systems like having childbirth attendant. Just birth attendant presence can reduce maternal mortality almost by 50 to 60%.
In Nepal, for example, are women often having giving birth alone without an attendant?
Just like many developing countries, yes. The answer is, on an average, throughout the world, overall birth attendants, we are not talking about OBGYN or physicians, just presence of any person trained in birth throughout the world is about 50%. And in many parts of Nepal, that number reduces to 20 to 30%.
Mm-hmm. That's
because the presence, the way Nepal is, the structure, hilly, remote, rural area, where there is no presence of any trained people.
So if you have a trained attendant, that will reduce this mortality rate significantly, you think?
Yes, it's well proven. The WHO's work and other international agencies' work have proven that by having birth attendant, they would find the presence of any acute problem. If there's hemorrhage, hopefully the birth attendant would know what to do, and they would have access to formal healthcare system and arrange to take a woman to that clinic.
Fascinating, this expedition here. Dr. Yogi Shah with us of Des Moines University. Charlie Whitmack with us as well. We have to take a break in about a minute, but very quickly, tell us, how is this expedition, 11 months, being financed?
We've got a lot of great support, and we're using the expedition to draw awareness and promote health here in central Iowa. Toyota Corporation has been just absolutely phenomenal to us, based here with Steve Lupke in Des Moines and Toyota of Des Moines. They've been our champion there with Toyota. And then Mercy Health, all around Iowa. We've been working with Mercy on some health programs in their group, and then we'll be moving that out to other areas in the state after the first of the year. And we've had a lot of support from the outdoor industry itself with Active Endeavors here in Des Moines and then the outdoor manufacturers that they represent. So altogether, I think, Ben, we've got probably 40 to 50 companies that we're in partnership with that have helped us put this thing together.
Okay. We want to follow up on more of the stories from this World Triathlon. If you'd like to find out more about it, theworldtri.com is the website where you can read Charlie Whitmack's blog, actually written by his wife, Kate, and maybe a few keystrokes there by James, the 2-year-old, do you think, Charlie?
Yeah, he gets in there every now and then, too. Yeah.
Okay, we want to have you two stay close, and we'll be talking with you in our second half hour as well. 1-866-780-9100. Questions that you have about this expedition for Charlie Whitmack and Dr. Yogi Shah. 1-866-780-9100. The exchange at iowapublicradio.org is our email. We're also on Twitter at IPR Talk. When we come back, we'll make sure to talk about the last leg, which is the walk to the base of Mount Everest and then the summit of Mount Everest. We'll have Charlie talk about that when we come back. This is The Exchange from Iowa Public Radio News.
Well, I guess my daddy had brought me up down along the road in a pickup truck.
And we're back with The Exchange from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Today we're following up with Des Moines explorer and adventurer Charlie Whitmack. We've had him on our program a couple of times. The last time we spoke with him, you remember, was in August. Perhaps he was finishing his swim portion of his World Triathlon, finishing up by swimming the English Channel. He picked up from there, right from the shore, bicycled across Europe, and has completed his bicycle leg of this massive World Triathlon, which takes place over 11 months, an unprecedented 10,000-mile triathlon from England to the summit of Mount Everest, and it's all also to help in a humanitarian mission that we've been exploring this hour as well. Charlie Whitmack with us, Dr. Yogi Shah of Des Moines University, Associate Dean of Global Health there. And we want to invite you with your questions and comments for Charlie Whitmack and Dr. Yogi Shah, 1-866-780-9100, 1-866-780-9100. The Exchange at iowapublicradio.org is our email. We're also on Twitter at IPR Talk. As a matter of fact, during the break, we had someone tweet about our music going out there, Charlie, and you would recognize that because this is one of the things you said, one of the many, many songs, and you do have plenty of time to listen to songs that you had on your bicycle. That was the Avett Brothers, right?
You know, it's funny. Yeah, you do have a lot of time, and I had a routine every day that I would I was very low on funds when I reached Prague, and so I got on Audible.com and I downloaded the longest book I could get. And if you get on there, they give you one for free. So I downloaded the Bible, and it's 80 hours. So I'd start every morning with listening to a couple hours of that, and then I'd do 2 hours of a book on tape, you know, something some kind of literature, and then in the afternoon I'd turn to music and podcasts. So that was my day.
Mm-hmm. Is part of the big mental challenge there just occupying your mind over these long stretches on the bike in this case?
Well, you know, the cycling is better. The swimming was the hardest part because there's no, your senses are totally shut off. You know, you're in the water. You can't see anything. You can't smell anything. You really lose your sense of feeling also because it's all day in the water. So by the time I got on the bike, it was almost sensory overload. You know, there was sight, sound, smell, taste going through those big cities, and it was great. So
did you get
you
some of
have
the
a lot of time to think?
Did you get going the smells and the sights? Did you get any local cuisine as you passed through these places?
Oh yeah, absolutely. I ate local the entire way. So you know, when I was by myself, I think it was 2.5 months I was cycling alone, and obviously I don't speak Russian. Or any of the local languages in these countries. So I would pull in, you know, it was literally weeks and weeks where I had no idea what I would eat for a meal.
Mm-hmm.
I would pull in and point at something on the menu and they would bring it out.
The last Thursday you wrote on the World Triathlon's Facebook page, Kate found me asleep on the couch today. This is while when you're back in Des Moines, back in Iowa, and said, Charlie Whitmack survives the World Tri only to be finally and completely exhausted by his 2-year-old.
Yeah, little James is it's fun to be home. I mean, the break right now is just perfect to get to come home and spend Thanksgiving with my family, and I'll be here for Christmas and then head back out on the road.
Mm-hmm. Besides, in addition to extensive lengths of time on your couch resting, what else has been keeping you busy during this break back in Iowa?
You know, we've been trying to always organize the business side of this, meet with our partners and our sponsors and make sure they're getting what they need, and we have a good program for the spring. I'm meeting with some book publishers this week out in New York, so I've been working on that, trying to get the speakers bureaus kind of online so we can pay the final bills for this thing when I get home. Mm-hmm. But most of all, yeah, just enjoying time with my wife and son.
Before we talk about looking towards the last leg, the walk and the climb of Mount Everest, I want to talk to Dr. Yogi Shah about the humanitarian side of this. Now, why did you pick Nepal as a place to focus your efforts?
A good question, Ben. I heard Charlie's journey first time, I was extremely impressed and decided to meet him in person just to find out how his mind decided such a long journey. And during that time, we talked about partnering and doing something more than adventure part. And as I was part of Global Health, where at DMU we have a nice department to promote intent concepts of global health within our students. And we have a few other countries we work with, India, South Africa, and others. So I suggested to Charlie about working in Nepal, since that was the place where Charlie would spend many months. And Nepal, I knew, had need for maternal education and infant mortality education. And Charlie, because of his connections in Nepal and his past connections with people in Nepal, he liked the idea, and we started working on Nepal.
1-866-780-9100, The Exchange at iowapublicradio.org, to talk to Charlie Whitmack or Dr. Yogi Shah. Let's go to George in Churden. Hi, George.
Yeah, hi. I was just wondering what kind of reception Charlie receives from the people in some of these out-of-the-way countries like Kazakhstan, and to what extent does for his safety, does he depend on just the goodwill of the people, or does he depend on police authorities?
Good question, George.
It's a great question. Thanks, George. You know, that was one of the neatest parts of this expedition is getting to see these people. And I left America with a lot of uncertainty. You know, I would see people or women sometimes in traditional Muslim dress, and it would catch me off guard. I went across the world, and I was welcomed openly by all these people, of different faiths and different backgrounds. And it was a life-changing experience for me. When I was hit by the car in Kazakhstan, there was the men that pulled over to help me were Muslim. They had the Muslim hats on, and they said, "Brother, you know, can we help you?" The folks in China, just absolutely amazing. The Buddhists and the Hindus and everywhere I turned, people were opening their arms and trying to help me. One place it was funny was in Russia. And the experience in Russia is there's still a little bit of a competitive nature among the Russians. And so I would say they were maybe the least opening, but still friendly, but a little bit more cautiously. Mm-hmm. And I could sense that there was still a little bit of the Cold War competitive spirit alive and well through Russia.
With these people, these locals you met, were they at times perhaps mystified by why you were on this expedition? What exactly were you doing? It's so far removed from... well, most of our daily existence here.
You know, the local people I met along the way, I didn't have a chance to fully connect with them. Mm. We're just moving too quickly. The folks I did have a chance to connect with were the support people, and the people that supported me through most of these countries were local people. And there was a day in every country where they finally got it. You know, they understood the physical aspect of the expedition, and they wanted to be part of it. You know, in all of those countries, these are places where people don't have the luxury or the opportunity to enjoy recreation. And so when you come in as an American athlete and an explorer and you're going to ride your bike across their country and nobody's ever done that before, they're a little bit trying to figure out why anybody would ever want to do that and what the point is. Mm-hmm. But in each of those countries, there was a moment when they were, you know, in the Toyota Land Cruiser driving along with me, and it got so hard and so difficult. And as a team, we accomplished something physically that they thought would be impossible, and they had told me earlier would be impossible, and then they got it. And they understood the importance and the purpose of overcoming these obstacles and taking on these physical challenges.
To make sure
and
we
that was fun.
Mm-hmm, to make sure we answer George's question, no security concerns, threats or anything
there,
like that?
There really was. There were security concerns really all the way. You know, months before I left, much of the government of Poland was killed in a very tragic car accident. So they were kind of going through the process of resolving that. You know, in Russia, there's quite a bit of theft and robbery, and I was in very remote areas, so there was concern there. I had some local guides there. In Kazakhstan, I actually had an armed escort. I was in a very remote area of the desert and spent, I think in the end, almost 3 weeks traveling through a desert where there are only nomads and it's kind of a lawless area. Kyrgyzstan's government had been overthrown. I actually delayed my entrance into Kyrgyzstan by a few days to allow them to have an election, which was their first parliamentary election ever and the first election since the revolution, which just took place in February and then again in April. And then in the area in China where I was traveling, there are three states, Tibet and two others, that were occupied by China in the 1960s, and there's a lot of friction there. The people in those states really resent being occupied by China, and so it's a very difficult area. But Nepal was great. You know, Western Europe is great, but there were a lot of security concerns, and we had to be very, very careful.
1-866-780-9100, the exchange at iowapublicradio.org. Our email, Rick in Cedar Rapids, asks via email, what kind of food did you eat on the Asian portion of the bike ride? Imagine you encountered a number of dishes that they don't have it here in Iowa.
Yeah, I called my wife from China, and I had been there for a week, and I said, I still haven't figured out what they eat for breakfast here. There was no milk that I could find. They certainly didn't have cereal or toast or things like that. And finally, I learned the breakfast in China was something called momo, which is sort of like a steamed dumpling with meat in it. And so, yeah, it was... Everything you can imagine. A lot of the things that come to mind, you know, a lot of salads in Russia, even in Kazakhstan. They love beets. So beets are the major sweetener there, and you eat beets really with every meal. There's a beet soup that's served breakfast, lunch, and dinner. You know, every type of meat you can imagine. A lot of rice dishes and noodle dishes as I went through China. And any type of food you can imagine, it was served at some point on this expedition.
Michael is joining us from Dubuque. Good afternoon, Michael. Welcome to The Exchange.
Well, thank you. Good afternoon, everyone. I just had a quick question. You know, when you're planning your trip, how long did it take to plan your route? And what all went into planning where you were going, if you had talked to local governments before you entered or before you set up your trip? And, you know, how long everything that, like, the time span that before you went over there to get everything ready?
Good question, Michael.
Michael, this was a dream I had since I was a little boy. I'm 33 now. I came up with the idea when I was about 14 years old, and the original route was to go south. The Silk Road route goes south. That's the historic route, but it's not possible now. To do that, you'd have to cross Afghanistan, Pakistan, difficult portions of India, Iran, and that's not safe for Americans now. So I was fortunate in the time I planned this. The Cold War ended. The Iron Curtain came down, and I could take the northern route across what was formerly the USSR. So the official planning, although the dream and the sort of informal planning took almost two decades, the formal planning, when I sat down with pen and paper and started making the plans, it took about 2 years. And the little algorithm I set up just to get the visas to visit all these countries, that was almost a six-month process. Getting the passport, sending the passport off to these various countries to get the approval to visit their countries, it was very, very difficult, and it did take a long time and a lot of planning.
Amazing. A few minutes ago, you talked about your reception, how people received you at various points along this world triathlon. Dr. Yogi Shah, you are leading efforts to reduce maternal mortality in Nepal, the humanitarian mission of this expedition. Let's ask you, how are the Nepalese in terms of being open to these education efforts to reduce maternal mortality?
When anywhere in the world, when our students go or I go for medical education, we make sure we deliver what that place, that country needs. It's never a right thing to just go and show what we have and show our mm-hmm. superiority in medical knowledge. People don't receive that well. So what the reason I'm going to go with Charlie and talk to some of the key people in January is to find out what they need and how we as Des Moines University and community of physicians from Iowa help them for their need rather than just go and deliver what we think is the best for them.
Mm-hmm. A lot of cultural things you have to keep in mind, too, just not importing Western medicine. You have to understand why they've done it up to this time the way they have.
Oh, definitely. And that's one of the key thing I hope that my students learn when they go and do rotations in different part of the world. They come back as culturally rich people. As you know, that in few years, our clinicians will have come across a lot of different ethnic groups within U.S., and they'll have to deal with and treat them well. So to do that, they'll have to know how different cultures react to different medical messages.
So this is go ahead, sorry.
And then they do learn. Studies show that when clinicians, especially medical students, travel to different part of the world, like what Charlie and we are planning, they come back as better clinicians. They come back as clinicians who are cost conscious. They come back and go to different and poor parts of U.S. And fourth, and I think the most important thing is they are culturally very open and rich.
Mm-hmm. So you really, your description tells me this is very much a two-way street, not only giving expertise to the Nepalese, but also receiving the training that you can only have when you're put in a different setting outside of the United States.
Oh, definitely. It has to be give and take. It has to be that, yes, we are here to learn from your style of practice. And in return, if we can offer, that's good. And our students learn very soon, as Charlie mentioned, that anywhere in the world, once you start traveling, you realize that faith and religion, they all lead to the same path. And we learn a lot. Our students learn a lot, and they come back as more humble people. And they feel how appreciated our healthcare system is, how much more we have to offer to our patients. Examples for pregnancy, we have an unlimited number of ultrasounds during our pregnancy, where in most part of the developing world, there might be one or two ultrasounds throughout that whole country. Doctor, students learn that and come back and become better clinicians.
Dr. Yogi Shah is with us, Associate Dean of Global Health at Des Moines University. In connection with the World Triathlon, Dr. Shah is leading an effort to try to reduce maternal mortality in Nepal. Charlie Whitmack with us, and please give us a preview of what's coming next. The third leg, you're on your legs, literally, and your aim is to summit Mount Everest. If I have my facts right, I remember because we interviewed you before you did it and after you did it. The first Iowan to summit Mount Everest, you've attempted it once. You've succeeded once, which is beating the odds. I think it's like, isn't it attempts to summits something like 5 to 1?
It's worse than that, Ben. The statistic I think you're thinking of is 5 to 1 is actually the ratio of fatalities to success. And the statistic is that historically, for every five people that reach the summit of Everest, there's one person that dies trying. Mm-hmm. So it's a very, very dangerous mountain, a serious undertaking, and that'll finish up this expedition. So the next leg will start about 4 weeks from now. I'll stay here for the holiday and head back to Kathmandu, Nepal. I've got about 1,300 miles left on the bicycle, which will take me to Calcutta, which is sort of on the southern coast of India there at the Bay of Bengal. And I'll then begin the run there in Calcutta and run this distance, which is going to be roughly 1,200 miles up into the Himalayas, and then take that expedition climbing up to the summit of Everest.
Mm-hmm. So with one attempt and one successful summiting of Everest, thinking back on that, I'm remembering that you took quite a bit of a risk during a time of storms in what is called the dead zone. Area of very thin air up at the peak of Mount Everest. Describe that moment quickly. What happened
there?
Well,
on Everest, it's all calculated risk. So I reached the summit during the worst weather in the recorded history of the mountain. I made three different attempts to reach the top over about a 2.5 month period. In the end, I did reach the summit. I spent 3 days without food or water, a day without oxygen. And as I completed that, I was so dehydrated, my tongue was swollen up like a balloon from dehydration. So it was a very tough go and a very tough year. And hopefully this year will be a whole lot better and more fun.
This is an area we have to remember that so many people have died trying to do this. In fact, along the trail that you went up, there are frozen bodies still there from previous attempts, previous years. Now, you are a father. You weren't a father during your first attempt. What year was that again?
2003.
James is now 2 years old, your young son. Do you think you look at risk differently now that you're a father?
You know, I really do. And my first reaction after becoming a father was that I was going to focus on my work and stay in the office and eliminate risk entirely from my life. You know, shortly after that, my wife was diagnosed with cancer. And we went through that experience with Katie, and it changed our perspective. And so I realized through that experience that life is not a guarantee. Even if we live a life without risk, there's no guarantee that we'll be there when our kids get married. And in realizing that, I realized that I had an obligation to James to be myself. And the things that one of the things that makes me passionate in life is taking on these challenges. And the lesson for James in that is that he can achieve things that other people think are impossible. And I want him to learn that lesson. You know, as a son that I am, you know, I don't think my father would have ever dreamed that he would have a son that would have the opportunity to do the things that I've had to do. And I hope for my son, for James, that the things that he dreams of and accomplishes in his life are things that I can't even see right now as his father. But I want him to be motivated and ambitious enough to identify those dreams and to spend his life pursuing them. It's a very rewarding experience.
What are your rules of risk management? We have just a few seconds left, but
I listen to that silent voice. There's a voice that's with me, and I pray, and I I take in every ounce of information that the world offers me. And beyond that, you know, it's in God's hands.
Okay. Charlie and Dr. Shaw, we've come to an end of the hour. I want you, please, to remind us how we keep track of you, Charlie, in the coming months.
Well, I appreciate people to go to Facebook, facebook.com, and we are The World Try, so /The World Try on Facebook, or join us at theworldtry.com.
And Dr. Shaw, go ahead.
Yeah, for us and our work in Nepal and anywhere where students go, our website is www.dmu.edu, and there's a global health site on that where we post our students' journey to different parts of the world, including it will be about Nepal.
Dr. Yogi Shaw, thank you so much of Des Moines University. Charlie Whitmack, we'll talk to you again after you've hopefully summited Everest. Come back to us here in Iowa safe and sound.
I look forward to it. Thanks so much, Ben.
Thank you, Ben.
Okay, thank you very much. And we want to take you out with a little bit of music that that has accompanied Charlie on his iPod as he goes through these various stages of his world triathlon. And I'll mention the exchange is produced by Catherine Perkins and Alex Hoyer. Production assistance today from Lindsay Moon. Technical support from Dennis Reese in Des Moines. John Pemble helped us out. The executive producer of Iowa Public Radio's talk shows is Jeff Schmidt. The exchange is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us. Here's some of that music that accompanied Charlie Whitmack.
Done laid around, done stayed around this old town too long. Summer's almost gone. Winter's coming on. Done laid around, done stayed around this old town too long. And it seems like I've got to travel on. And it seems like I've got to travel on. Papa writes to Johnny. Johnny can't come home. Johnny can't come home. Johnny can't come home. Papa rides to Johnny. Johnny can't come home. Johnny's been out on the road too long. So I done laid around, done stayed around this old town too long. Summer's almost gone. Winter's coming on.